Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Laura Carlson of the Center for International Policy, who assesses the promising first days of Mexico's newly sworn-in progressive president, Andrés Manuel López Obrador. Rachel Weber of End the Deadly Exchange Campaign, who talks about her group's successful efforts to end joint U.S.-Israeli police counterterrorism training. And Arun Gupta, an independent investigative journalist who examines the darker side of the late President George Herbert Walker Bush's record in office that he maintains set the stage for some of the most controversial policies of President Donald Trump. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
After a long-running battle with Nationalist Prime Minister Viktor Orban, Central European University in Budapest, founded by George Soros, is leaving Hungary. The university, with one of Europe's most highly respected graduate schools, is moving to Vienna. For nearly 2 years, the university has been the target of harassment by Orban's right-wing government, which has systematically consolidated control and marginalized dissent. Legislation passed by Parliament in 2017 appeared to specifically target the university by requiring all foreign-based schools in Hungary to also have academic programs in their home countries. Although the university instituted a program at Bard College in New York State that was certified by state authorities, the Hungarian government refused to acknowledge the arrangement. Neither the European Union nor Trump-appointed U.S. ambassador to Hungary, David Kornstein, was willing to stand up to Orban. The attacks on Soros increased anti-Semitic passions in the formerly communist nation. Orban's condemnation of Soros for allegedly trying to undermine Hungary's Christian culture, his rehabilitation of Hungarian Nazi collaborators, and his promotion of a nationalist ideology strikingly reminiscent of the 1930s are inciting and legitimizing hatred and suspicion of Jews. An inquiry by Britain's Parliamentary Investigative Committee has exposed how Facebook handed over users' data to favored advertisers and app developers, including Netflix, Airbnb, and Lyft. The classified documents were released as part of a lawsuit against Facebook in California by app developer 643. User data shared included Facebook posts and photos along with names, gender, education, and religious background. Tech companies like Cambridge Analytica and thousands of app developers were given access to user data over several years. The internal communications, some of them from Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg, appear to show Facebook trading access to user data in exchange for advertising buys and other concessions, which would contradict Facebook's longstanding claim that it doesn't sell people's information. Earlier releases of Facebook documents show how top company executives gave select advertisers access to user data during the rollout of Facebook's mobile platform. Facebook did create limits on access to user data in 2014 and 2015. However, app developers like 643 say the move to restrict access to data was done to maximize profits and not to protect users' privacy. In Tijuana, along the U.S.-Mexican border, Central American and other migrants gather early in the morning to get their names on the list in a black and white notebook kept by asylum seekers. The list helps create a sense of order in a chaotic situation at this port entry to the United States. According to the Christian Science Monitor, each holder of the list will keep the notebook for several weeks until their asylum application is called. The notebook will then be handed off to another asylum seeker. The Trump administration employs a system called metering, which limits the number of asylum seekers allowed to enter the U.S. each day to launch the asylum request process based on a claim of credible fear of returning home. Because of a combination of Trump's hardline zero-tolerance policies and a shortage of judges to hear the process cases, some observers estimate there's now a backlog of more than 1 million such cases in U.S. immigration courts. Once launched, the asylum process can range from months to years. The timeline differs depending on factors such as port of entry, the age of applicants, the number of beds open in nearby detention centers, and just plain luck. Now that the 6,000-strong migrant caravan has arrived in Tijuana, the wait at this point of entry is expected to grow to 2 months or more. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I am Richard Hill.
Andrés Manuel López Obrador was sworn in as Mexico's new president on December 1st, pledging to end corruption and impunity and work to transform the nation on behalf of the poor majority. The former mayor of Mexico City, known as AMLO, won his third bid for the presidency in a landslide vote on July 1st, ushering in a new era as Mexico's first leftist president in some 70 years. López Obrador and his National Regeneration Movement party, Morena, vowed to end decades of neoliberal economic policy that the populist president believes has exacerbated inequality. Other major challenges the new leader will confront include a record murder rate linked with a militarized drug war and major disagreements with U.S. President Donald Trump over Washington's hard-line immigration policy. While AMLO maintained a high approval rating of 56% as he entered office, his predecessor, Enrique Peña Nieto, leaves the presidency with historically low public support. Your reporter spoke with Laura Carlson, director of the Americas program at the Center for International Policy, who talks about López Obrador's hopeful first days in office and Mexico's dramatic break with the past.
Here in Mexico, there's a five-month period between the elections and the inauguration, which is really long. And so during that time, we saw a real different form of a style of governing than we've seen in the past as well, even before he took office, because he really hit the ground running. He was already announcing plans, getting his team into place, having daily meetings, receiving all kinds of complaints and petitions from the citizenry. More than 20,000 people were received with everything from, from please use a guard because we don't want you to get assassinated, to resolving land conflicts in small communities in the southern state of Oaxaca. So there was all kinds of hopes that government could actually solve problems. Which I think, in many ways, we haven't seen for a long time. Much of the reason that he was elected was because people had gotten to the point where they looked at government and they believed that government only caused problems. And the violence, the economic inequality, those problems had become so severe in Mexico that people were willing to take a chance on a new kind of government.
Laura, from the election results, it seems the public has invested a lot of hope in López Obrador and his presidency. As someone who's been observing Mexican politics for decades now, how would you gauge the promises that AMLO has made during his campaign versus what the public expects from him?
So far, we've seen some contradictions. The expectations are really high, and it's inevitable that there will be some disappointments. It's inevitable that there will be some mistakes. There have already actually have been, including kind of a lack of coordination between the Morena-run Congress and the president, and some real jittery financial markets that have reacted strongly against some of the announcements that the new government has made and they've had to rectify, including one was had to do with bank commissions, stating that bank commissions would be frozen in Mexico. The banks gouge clients almost worse than anywhere else in the world, with commissions and fees and all that kind of thing. But the markets responded severely when they announced that law, and they had to kind of take a step back from it. The biggest contradictions so far have been that the promise to change the model, the security model, became a plan concretely to create what they call the National Guard. Now, a National Guard, a civil National Guard, has existed mostly just in theory in Mexico, but this is a military National Guard. And so many people, including myself, who've worked on the security issue and strongly believe that the war on drugs should be ended and that the fight against organized crime should be demilitarized within Mexican territory, we're very disappointed and are watching to see what happens with this specific proposal. Some of his supporters claim that he's still planning to demilitarize and that this is just kind of a stopgap measure as they begin to bring organized crime under control with other measures included in a broader picture, including a more aggressive attack against money laundering, looking at addiction and the use of drugs as a health issue, and especially providing social programs that will provide education and jobs for young people. So it's really more of a medium to long-term package, but the idea that it will continue to be so militarized is disturbing to many people. The other real sensitive point is, and it's been brought up many times, how will he fund the social programs that he's promised? They include scholarships for young people, new schools, new health clinics, pensions for the elderly, pensions for differently abled. There's a lot of support also for the countryside, for rural production, because the countryside in Mexico has been kind of slowly dying as a part of the economy for a long time now. So there's a lot of promises that have to do with government-sponsored social programs, and it's not clear where the money's come from. López Obrador said that just rolling back the corruption will release millions and millions and millions of pesos worth of funds, which is probably true. It's been estimated that it's an enormous percentage of the economy that goes into corruption. But the numbers of, you know, what's planning to be spent and what they're likely to get, especially since some of those measures are more long-term, recovering money that's gone to corruption or a new fiscal program and taxes, is going to be one of the biggest challenges.
That was Laura Carlson, director of the Center for International Policies Americas program, based in Mexico City. Find more analysis and commentary on Mexico's new president, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. For years, Israel has invited U.S. law enforcement agencies to send their members to Israel for counterterrorism training. Thousands of the highest-ranking police and other security officials from across the country have participated in the exchange programs. When Jewish Voice for Peace learned that some of the sponsoring organizations that pay for the trips included the Jewish Federations of North America and the Anti-Defamation League, or ADL, the group initiated a campaign in March 2017 called End the Deadly Exchange. Jewish Voice for Peace contends that the training allows both Israeli and U.S. participants to learn from each other's worst practices, tactics that violate human rights, and often result in the deaths of members of at-risk communities, both African Americans and Palestinians. The campaign scored its first two victories in two consecutive days in late November, when high-ranking police officials in both Massachusetts and Vermont, who had planned on participating in the exchange, canceled their involvement. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Rachel Weber, a volunteer organizer with End the Deadly Exchange campaign from Northampton, Massachusetts. Here she explains how her group learned about who would be participating and how they convinced officials to withdraw from the exchange program.
We see these trainings as an exchange of worst police practices, where our local police and our state police are going to train alongside ICE agents and Border Patrol agents with security forces that are part of maintaining an active military occupation. And both the tactics and the very divisive pedagogy that goes into that, when you look at how Israeli security forces operate in Israel, there's a pedagogy which allows many Palestinians to be defined as terrorists and therefore are afforded far less civil and human rights, with indefinite detentions without trial or charges, with interrogation techniques that would certainly amount to torture if they were done here in this country, with extrajudicial killings and, you know, looking at what happened in Gaza with protesters being fired upon by snipers at the border. And so when you look at those, both the thinking that allows that, and also within Israel, there is a very, very racialized social hierarchy with Ethiopian Jews, Mizrahi Jews, Arab Palestinians, Bedouin communities being subjected to racialized police and bureaucratic violence. And so not wanting our police forces to train in that setting. And then it also ends up being an exchange where Israeli police learn bad police tactics from U.S. police, where we've taught them about broken windows policing and other tactics which would bring harm to communities that are targeted for violence by Israeli security forces. So from our perspective, you know, this is, again, it's a two-way exchange of terrible policing practices that we didn't want brought here to our town.
So please explain the process that ended with the result that you wanted.
So starting this past summer, our chapter started sending out public records requests to towns and agencies covering several different counties, from the Berkshires out to Worcester, from the Connecticut border up to the Vermont border. And through those records requests, we ended up learning that in December of this year, there was going to be a counterterrorism seminar aimed at New England law enforcement. And one of the places that we had sent a records request to said, well, we've never gone before, but we just got this invitation about something coming up in December. So then once we learned about that there was an actual specific training coming up in December, we then sent out new public records requests asking specifically if folks were going to this particular seminar. And of all the places that we sent requests to, the only yes that we got back was from the Northampton Chief of Police, Jody Casper. We found out on October 19th that Jody Casper was going on this trip, and the trip was supposed to be happening this week from December 2nd to December 11th. Once I received that email, because I had, since I live here in Northampton, I was the one who'd sent out the records requests to Northampton. So when we got that information, then our core organizing folks came up with a strategy, also working in tandem with some of the organizers working on the national and the Deadly Exchange campaign, where we wanted to see if we could have a private meeting with the mayor to address some of our concerns, because what we feared, and which turned out to be correct, is that he simply saw that the ADL was sponsoring a training, and his thinking was, well, the ADL is a wonderful organization, why wouldn't I say yes to this? There wasn't very much thought put into the implications. And so we assembled a team of folks who really represented broader swaths of the community. So we had two different city councilors, one of whom, Alyssa Klein, had lived in Israel, served in the Israeli military, and has been doing anti-occupation work for decades since then. We had Rose Bookbinder, who's an organizer with the Pioneer Valley Worker Center, which is an immigrant-led advocacy organization. They've been doing a lot of really amazing work around protecting immigrants in this community. We also had Michelle Mushabek, who is an internationally known Palestinian musician and book publisher. And we had Vijay Prashad, who founded a think tank called Tricontinental, and that is actually located here. Well, one of his offices is here in Northampton, but they're around the globe. And he's been covering affairs in Israel and Palestine for the last 30 years or so. So we had, you know, sort of a range of interests in the room.
Wow, Rachel Weber, you really had the A-list on your side.
And we had a meeting with the mayor, and he invited the police chief, and we had an hour-long meeting where we really got into the heart of what our concerns were, and then ended up following that up, asking some select folks to send emails to him about why this was important to them. And that also brought in additional voices from the community, folks involved in different aspects of the Jewish community, other professors who teach here at Smith in town, other people who work and own businesses and live here in Northampton. So we tried to really show the mayor that this wasn't just an issue that was only of concern to, you know, one particular small group of people, that this really was of huge concern to a wide array of people in the community. And then we heard about a week after our meeting that he canceled.
So Jewish Voice for Peace has been working on this End the Deadly Exchange campaign for a while, and now you got these two successes on two consecutive days, where the director of the Vermont State Police had planned to go and canceled on November 26th, and the mayor of Northampton canceled the participation of his chief of police the next day.
The JVP's understanding, this is the first time that anyone has withdrawn participation due to public pressure as a result of the End the Deadly Exchange campaign.
That was Rachel Weber, a volunteer organizer with End the Deadly Exchange, a campaign initiated by Jewish Voice for Peace. Learn more about the campaign by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. When George Herbert Walker Bush died on November 30th, the nation's corporate media recounted a predictably sanitized version of the 41st president's public life. Bush, who served as a Navy pilot during World War II, a Texas congressman, United Nations ambassador, CIA director, and vice president under Ronald Reagan, was largely uncritically portrayed as a patriot who dedicated his life to public service and sacrificed his own personal and political ambition for the promotion of democracy abroad and the good of the nation. During his time in office, Bush invaded Panama in order to overthrow its government, sent U.S. troops to drive Iraq out of Kuwait, presided over U.S. policy during the fall of the Soviet Union, allied himself with death squads and corrupt repressive governments in Central America, and pardoned Reagan administration officials convicted of crimes in the Iran-Contra affair. After the end of the First Persian Gulf War, the elder Bush took credit for eliminating the Vietnam Syndrome, the American public's aversion to launching new military adventures abroad. Your reporter spoke with Arun Gupta, an author and independent investigative journalist who's written for dozens of publications and was a founding editor of New York's independent newspaper and news site. Here, Gupta examines the darker side of the late President Bush's record in office that he maintains set the stage for some of the most controversial policies of current U.S. President Donald Trump.
George Bush was Trump before Trump. The reason he's Trump before Trump is because he was an architect, one of the architects of the world that led to Trump. He was in the Reagan administration, where you have this systematic neoliberal assault on the working class, on the poor, on cities, on African Americans. And this is where you really start to get the runaway income inequality. I don't remember the exact figures, but, you know, like in 1980, the differential between the CEO and average worker was something like 20 to 30 to 1, right, of like a Fortune 500 company. Now it's something like 600 to 1, you know, but Bush wasn't there primarily on the domestic end, even though he went along with everything. He was much more interested in foreign policy, international relations, and really what he did during his time in office. And it's this long historical arc, right? We shouldn't understand George Herbert Walker Bush so much as a person. I think that that's a problem that the media have, this individualism, you know, as part of neoliberalism, right? Just focusing on the person. But as someone who represents, as an embedded in all these institutions. And so his historical life arc is really about one in the shadows, his in terms of the intelligence community, the CIA. And it really comes to fruition in the 1980s, and he helps to create it. In fact, I think is the primary architect, along with William Casey, the CIA chief, of this world of dictatorships, death squads, torture, and drug dealing that just ends up exploding into all these dirty wars. And it really, you know, metastasizes after September 11, 2001, under his son. And it creates, one, both the secret government that's involved in all these just machinations around the world, and it creates a lot of cynicism in the American public as well. And to a large degree, that's what Donald Trump fed off of.
The Iran-Contra scandal was a huge failure in terms of bringing to people justice who violated the law and all sort of morality. Right. And the dirty wars in Central America during the early and mid-1980s in places like El Salvador, Nicaragua, Guatemala, and Honduras. Just mention a bit about George H.W. Bush's role in the Iran-Contra scandal.
A lot of these dirty wars were conducted right out of George Bush's office in conjunction with the CIA director, Casey, and they were run by veterans of the Phoenix program. That's why these connections are important. And they continue into the Iraq war and occupation, where you find veterans of the dirty war in Central America, specifically El Salvador. So there were all these investigations. There was a special counsel. There was all this evidence of cover-up. All these documents were shredded before the attorney general at the time, Edwin Meese, bothered to secure Oliver North's office. They violated all sorts of congressional laws, the Arms Export Control Act, like in sending arms to Iran illegally. They violated the Boland Amendment, which prohibited any direct or indirect military aid by basically any government, military, or intelligence service to the Contras. So they violated all these acts. And Walsh is closing in on Bush when in 1992, Christmas Eve, just a few weeks before he was going to leave office because Clinton was elected in November, Bush pardons six key figures, including the defense secretary, Caspar Weinberger, four of whom had been convicted, because he was almost certainly going to be called as a witness during Weinberger's trial. The trial was set to begin in 12 days. And Walsh was on the verge of criminally charging George Bush Sr. himself. So this is what I mean, that George Bush was Trump before Trump. Everything you think Trump may have done, Bush actually did. He violated all these laws. He engaged in this massive cover-up. He trashed the rule of law and the Constitution. And so, you know, all this praise just being heaped on him is just a giant attempt to bury all these skeletons.
That was Arun Gupta, an author and independent investigative journalist. Learn more about the conduct and legacy of the late President George H.W. Bush, not covered by the corporate media, by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our newly designed and mobile-friendly website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WUML in Lowell, Massachusetts, KPSQ in Fayetteville, Arkansas, KMUD in Garberville, California, and dozens of other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Richard Hill, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.